Lots of money, which we don't have. Greer drummed his fingers on the table. There are ways around that. Assuming we had the manpower, how long would we need? Years. Hell, maybe decades. We'd have to drain her, build a dry dock, float her in. And that's just for starters. The damn thing's 600 feet long. But it could be done. In theory. Michael studied his friend's face. They had yet to touch on the missing piece, the one question from which all the rest descended. So how much time do you think we have? Michael asked. Until what? Until the virals come back. Greer didn't answer right away. I'm not sure. But they are coming. Greer looked up. Michael saw relief in the man's eyes. He had been alone with this for too long. Tell me, how did you figure it out? It's the only thing that makes sense. The question is, how did you? Greer drained his whiskey, poured another, and drank that too. Michael waited. I'm going to tell you something, Michael, and you can never tell anybody what you know. Not Sarah, not Hollis, not Peter. Especially not Peter. Why him? I don't make the rules, I'm sorry. I need your word on this. You have it. Greer drew a long breath and let the air out slowly. I know the virals are coming back, Michael, he said. Because Amy told me. 13. Rain was falling as Alicia approached the city. Seen from above in the soft morning light, the river was as she'd imagined it, wide, dark, ceaselessly flowing. Beyond it rose the spires of the city, dense as a forest. Ruined piers jutted from the banks. Wrecks of ships were washed against the shoals. In a century, the sea had risen. Parts of the island's southern tip looked submerged, water lapping against the sides of the buildings. She picked her way north, hopscotching through the detritus, searching for a way across. The rain stopped, started, stopped again. It was late afternoon when she reached the bridge. Two massive struts, like giant twins, holding the decks aloft with cables slung over their shoulders. The thought of crossing it filled Alicia with a profound anxiety she dared not show. But Soldier sensed it anyway. The smallest notch of reluctance in his gait. This again? Yes, she thought. This. She veered inland and located the ramp. Barricades, gun emplacements, military vehicles stripped bare by a century of weather, some overturned or lying on their sides. There had been a battle here. The upper deck was choked with the carcasses of automobiles, painted white by the droppings of birds. Alicia dismounted and led Soldier through the wreckage. With every step, her apprehension increased. The feeling was automatic, like an allergy, a sneeze barely held in abeyance. She kept her eyes forward, putting one foot in front of the next. About mid-span, they came to a place where the roadway had collapsed. Cars lay in a twisted heap on the deck below. A narrow ledge along the guardrail, 4 feet wide at the most, presented the only viable pathway. No big deal, Alicia said to Soldier. Nothing to it. The height was irrelevant. It was the water she feared. Beyond the edge lay a swallowing maw of death. Step by step, jellied with dread, she led Soldier across. How strange, she thought, to fear nothing but this. The sun was behind them when they reached the far side. A second ramp guided them to street level, into an area of warehouses and factories. She remounted Soldier and headed south, along the backbone of the island. The numbered streets ticked down. Eventually the factories gave way to blocks of apartments and brownstones, interspersed with vacant lots, some barren, others like miniature jungles. In some places the streets were flooded, dirty river water bubbling up through the manholes. Never had Alicia been in such a place. The island's sheer density astounded her. She was aware of the tiniest sounds and movements. Pigeons cooing, rats scurrying, water dripping down the walls of the building's interiors. The acrid spore smell of mold. The funk of rot. The stench of the city itself. Death's temple. Evening came on. Bats flittered in the sky. She was on Lennox Avenue, in the 110s, when a wall of vegetation rose in her path. At the heart of the abandoned city, a woodland had taken root, flowering to massive dimensions. At its edge, she brought Soldier to a halt and tuned her thoughts to the trees. When the virals came, they came from above. It wasn't her they'd want, of course. Alicia was one of them. But there was Soldier to consider. She allowed a few minutes to go by, and when she was satisfied that they would pass in safety, tapped her heels to his flanks. "Let's go." Just like that, the city vanished. They could have been in the mightiest of ancient forests. Night had fallen in full, lit by a waning rind of moon. They came to a wide field of feathered grass tall enough to swish against her thighs. Then the trees again staked their claim upon the land. They emerged up a flight of stone steps onto 59th Street. Here the buildings had names. Helmsley Park Lane, Essex House, the Ritz-Carlton, the Plaza. She jogged east to Madison Avenue and headed south again. The buildings grew taller, towering above the roadway. The street numbers continued their relentless decline. 56th. 51st, 48th, 43rd, 42nd. She dismounted. The building was like a fortress, smaller than the great towers that surrounded it, but with a royal aspect. A castle, fit for a king. High arched windows gazed darkly upon the street. Along the roofline, at the center of the facade, a stone figure stood with his arms outstretched in welcome. Beneath this, etched into the building's face, chiseled in moonlight, were the words, "Grand Central Terminal." "Alicia, I'm here. Lish, I'm so glad that you have come." She could feel her brothers and sisters plainly now. They were everywhere beneath her, a vast repository curled in slumber in the bowels of the city. Did they sense her presence also? There was, Alicia realized, a single hour that all the days since your birth pointed you toward. What you thought was a maze of choices, all the possibilities of what your life might become, was in fact a series of steps you took along a road, and when you reached your destination and looked back, only one path, the one chosen for you, was visible. She clipped a rope to Soldier's bridle. Two nights before, camped on the outskirts of Newark, she'd prepared a pine knot torch. Now, crouched on the sidewalk, she shaved a pile of tinder, ignited it with her fire steel, and dipped the end of the torch in the flames until the pitch began to burn. She rose, holding it aloft. The torch, which would burn for hours, gave off a smoky orange light. She cinched her bandoliers tight to her chest, then reached her right hand over the opposite shoulder to withdraw her sword from its sheath. Bright-edged, hard-tipped, the cords at the handle worn from hours of practice, the object had no symbolic meaning for her. It was simply a tool. She swooped it slowly back and forth, feeling its power meld with her own. Soldier was watching her. When the moment felt right, Alicia resheathed her weapon and opened the door to the terminal. "It's time." She led him inside. Broken glass crunched underfoot. She heard the squeaks of rats. 10 feet past the door, two options. Straight ahead, down a sloping hallway to the station's lower level, or left, through an arched portal. She went left. Space expanded around her. She was in the main room of the station. But it did not seem like a station. More like a church. a place where vast crowds gathered to commune with one another in the company of some higher presence. Shafts of moonlight pulsed from the high windows onto the floor, spreading like a pale yellow liquid. The silence was intense. She could hear the blood swishing in her ears. Looking up, she saw what she thought was the sky until she realized it was a painting. Stars were strewn across the ceiling, and in their midst were figures. A bull, a ram, a man pouring water from a pitcher. Alicia. Hello. She startled. It was his voice. An audible, distinctly human-sounding voice. I'm over here. The sound came from the far end of the room. Alicia moved toward it, guiding Soldier beside her. Ahead she saw a structure. It looked like a small house. Positioned on top, like a crown, was a large four-faced clock. As she approached, the clock was the first thing to capture the glow of her torch, not so much reflecting the light as absorbing it, causing its faces to shine with an orange luster. Up here, Lish. A broad flight of stairs ascended to a balcony. She released the rope and placed her hand against Soldier's neck. His coat was damp with sweat. She pressed her palm against it with a calming gesture. Wait here. Don't worry. Your friend will be safe. He's a magnificent companion, Lish. More than I even imagined. Every inch a soldier. Like you. Like my Lish. She ascended the stairs, making no effort to conceal herself. There was no point. What form of creature awaited her? The voice was human, meager in a way, but the body surely wouldn't be. He would be a giant, a monster of gargantuan dimensions, a titan of his race. She reached the top. To her right was a bar with stools, straight ahead an area of tables, some overturned, others still set with china and silverware. Sitting at one of the tables, was a man. Was it a trick? Had he done something to her mind? He was sitting at ease, his hands folded on his lap, wearing a dark suit, a white shirt, collar undone at his throat. Sandy hair, almost red, with a sharp widow's peak, a slight sag around the jowls, eyes with a certain indefinable intensity. Suddenly nothing around her seemed real. It was all a gigantic joke. He was like any man, a figure in a crowd. No one, a person, would notice. Does my appearance surprise you? He asked. Perhaps I should have warned you. His voice aroused her to action. She dropped the torch, and the sword came out as she strode toward him. She swung it away from her body, cocked her hip, transferring energy to the large muscle groups, shoulders, pelvis, legs, and brought it around, halting its flight just inches from his neck. What the hell are you? Not a muscle had flinched. Even his face was relaxed. What do I look like? You're not human. You can't be. You might ask yourself the same thing. What it means to be human. He tipped his head toward her blade. If you're going to use that, I suggest you get on with it. Is that what you want? He angled his face toward the ceiling. At the corners of his mouth, dagger-like incisors revealed themselves. They were the teeth of a predator. And yet the face before her was mild. I've been waiting here rather a long time, you know. In 100 years, you get around to thinking about pretty much everything. All the things you did, the people you knew, the mistakes you made, the books you read, the music you listened to, how the sun felt, the rain. It's all still there inside you. But it's not enough, is it? That's the thing. The past is never enough. The sword was still poised at his neck. How simple he was making this. How easy. He was looking at her with an expression of perfect calm. One swift blow, and she would be free. "We're two of a kind, you see." His voice was placid, almost teacherly. "So much regret. So many things lost." Why hadn't she done it? Why had she failed to strike? A strange immobility had taken hold, not a physical paralysis, more a dimming of her will. "I have no doubt you are more than capable." He touched a spot on his neck. "Right about here, I think. That should do the trick." Something was wrong. Something was terribly wrong. All she had to do was pull back the sword and let fly. Yet she could not make herself do it.
"You can't, can you?"
He frowned. His tone was almost regretful. "Patricide goes against the grain, after all." "I killed Martinez. I watched him die."
"Yes. But you did not belong to him, Lish. You belong to me. The viral that bit you was one of mine. Amy is but one part of you. I am the other. You could no more use that sword on me than you could on her. I'm surprised you hadn't figured that out."
She felt the truth of his words. The sword. The sword. She could not move the sword.
"But I don't think you came to kill me. I don't think that's why you're here at all. I can see it. You have questions. There are things you want to know."
She answered through gritted teeth.
"I don't want anything from you."
"No?
Then I'll ask you something instead. Tell me, Alicia, what did being human ever get you?"
She felt disoriented. None of this made sense.
"It's a simple question, really. Most things are, in the end."
"I had friends," she said, and heard the shakiness in her voice. "People who loved me."
"Did they? Is that why you left them?"
"You don't know what you're talking about."
"I think I do. Your mind is an open book to me. Peter, Michael, Sarah, Hollis, Greer. And Amy. The great and powerful Amy. I know all about them. Even the boy, Hightop, who died in your arms. You promised him you would keep him safe. But in the end, you could not save him."
Her being was dissolving. The sword was like an anvil in her hand, incomparably dense.
"What would your friends say to you now? I'll answer for you. They would call you a monster. They would hound you from their midst if they didn't kill you first."
"Shut up, goddammit."
"You're not one of them. You never have been. Not since the day the colonel took you outside the walls and left you there. You sat there under the trees and cried all night. Isn't that so?"
How could he know these things?
"Did he comfort you, Alicia? Did he tell you he was sorry? You were just a little girl, and he left you all alone. You have always been alone."
The last of her resolve was failing. It was all she could do to hold the sword aloft.
"I know, because I know you, Alicia Donatio. I know your secret heart. Don't you see? That's why you've come to me. I'm the only one who does."
"Please," she begged. "Please, stop talking.
Tell me. What did you name her?"
she was undone. She had nothing left. Whoever she'd been, or wanted to be, she felt that person leaving her.
Tell me, Lish. Tell me your daughter's name.
Rose.
The word came out with a choking sound.
I named her Rose.
She had begun to sob. At some uncharted distance, the sword fell clattering to the floor. The man had risen and put his arms around her, drawing her into a warm embrace. She made no resistance, having none to offer. She cried and cried. Her little girl. Her Rose.
That's why you came here, isn't it?
His voice was soft, close to her ear.
That's what this place is for. You came to speak your daughter's name.
She nodded against him. She heard herself say,
Yes.
Oh, my Alicia, my Lish, do you know where you are? All your journeys are ended. What is home but a place where you are truly known? Say it with me. I've come home.
A flicker of resistance. Then she let it go.
I've come home. And I am never leaving here.
How easy it suddenly was.
And I am never leaving here.
A moment passed. He stepped away. Through her tears, she looked at his kind face, so full of understanding. He pulled a chair from the table.
Now, sit with me, he said. We have all the time in the world. Sit with me, and I will tell you everything.
2. The Lover, 28-3 BV, 1989-2014. From morn to noon he fell, from noon to dewy eve, a summer's day, and with the setting sun, dropped from the zenith like a falling star. Milton, Paradise Lost. 14.
Behind every great hatred is a love story. For I am a man who has known and tasted love. I say a man because that is how I know myself. Look at me, and what do you see? Do I not take the form of a man? Do I not feel as you do, suffer as you do, love as you do, mourn as you do? What is the essence of a man, if not these things? In life, I was a scientist called Fanning. Fanning, Timothy J., holder of the Eloise Armstrong Distinguished Chair in Biochemical Sciences, Columbia University. I was known and respected, a figure of my times. My opinions were sought on many subjects. I walked the hallways of my profession with my head held high. I was a man of connections. I shook hands, kissed cheeks, made friends, took lovers. Fortune and treasure flowed my way. I supped at the flower of the modern world. City apartments, country houses, sleek automobiles, good wine. All of these were things I had. I dined in fine restaurants, slept in upscale hotels. My passport was fat with visas. Thrice I wooed and thrice I wed. And although these unions came to naught, each was, in its final measure, no matter of regret. I worked and rested, danced and wept. Hoped and remembered.
even from time to time, prayed. I lived, in some, a life. Then, in a jungle in Bolivia, I died. You will know me as Zero. Such is the name that history has bestowed upon me. Zero the Destroyer, great devourer of the world. That this history shall never be written is a circumstance of ontological debate. What becomes of the past when there is no man to record it? I died, and then was brought to life, the oldest tale there is. I arose from the dead, and what did I behold? I was in a room of the bluest light, pure blue, cerulean blue, the blue the sky would be if it were married to the sea. My arms, legs, even my head were bound. I was a captive in that place. Scattered images lit my mind, flashes of light and color that refused to gather into meaning. My body was humming. That is the only word. I was to learn that I had just emerged from the final stages of my transformation. I had yet to see my body, being inside it. Tim, can you hear me? A voice, coming from everywhere and nowhere. Was I dead? Was this the voice of God addressing me? Perhaps the life I'd lived had been not so worthy, and things had gone the other way. Tim, if you can hear me, lift a hand. This did not seem too much for God, any God, to ask. That's it. Now the other one. Excellent. Well done, Tim. You know this voice, I said to myself. You are not dead. It is the voice of a human being like you. A man who calls you by name, who says, well done. That's it. Just breathe. You're doing fine. The nature of the situation was becoming clear. I had been ill in some manner. Perhaps I had suffered seizures. That would explain the restraints. I could not yet recall the circumstances, how I had come to be in this place. The voice was the key. If I could identify its owner, all would be revealed. I'm going to undo the straps now, okay? I felt a release of pressure, triggered by some remote mechanism. My bindings had surrendered their hold. Can you sit up, Tim? Can you do that for me? It was also true that whatever my ailment was, the worst had passed. I did not feel ill. Quite the contrary. The humming sensation, which originated in my chest, had enlarged to an orchestral, whole-body vibrato, as if all the molecules of my anatomy were playing a single note. The sensation was deeply, almost sexually pleasurable. My loins, the tips of my toes, even the roots of my hair. Never had I experienced anything so exquisite. A second voice, deeper than the first.
Dr. Fanning, I'm Colonel Sykes.
Sykes? Did I know a man named Sykes?
Can you hear us? Do you know where you are?
A hole had opened inside me. Not a hole. A maw. I was hungry. Deeply, madly hungry. Mine was the appetite not of a human being, but of an animal. A hunger of claws and teeth, of burrowing in, of soft flesh beneath the jaws and hot juices exploding upon the palate.
Tim, You've got us pretty worried in here. Talk to me, buddy.
And just like that, the gates of memory opened, releasing a flood. The rainforest, with its steamy air and dense green canopy full of hooting animals. The stickiness of my skin and the omnipresent swarm of insects around my face. The soldiers, scanning the trees with their rifles as we walked, their faces streaked with jungle paint. The statues, man-like figures of monstrous form, warning us away even as they called us forward, summoning us deeper into the heart of this vile place. The bats. They'd come at night, swarming our encampment. Bats by the hundreds, the thousands, the ten thousands, a flapping multitude. They blotted out the heavens. They took the sky by storm. The gates of hell had opened, and this was its disgorgement, its black vomitus. They seemed not to fly, but to swim, moving in organized waves, like a school of airborne fish. They fell upon us, all wings and teeth and vicious little squeaks of joy. I remembered the shots, the screams. I was in a place of blue light and a voice that knew my name, but in my mind I was running for the river. I saw a woman, writhing on the banks. Her name was Claudia. She was one of us. The bats had covered her like a cloak. Imagine it. The horror. Almost no part of her was visible. She twitched in a demonic dance of agony. In truth, my first instinct was to do nothing. I did not possess the heart of a hero. Yet sometimes we discover things about ourselves we never knew. I took two great leaps and tackled her, sending the two of us plunging into the fetid jungle water. I felt the hot stab of the bat's teeth in the flesh of my arms and neck. The water boiled with blood. Such was their fury that even the water did not deter them. They would feed upon us even as they drowned. I locked Claudia's neck in my elbow and dove down, though I knew this would come to nothing. The woman was already dead. I remembered all these things, and then one more. I remembered a man's face. It hovered above me, framed by jungle sky. I was insensate. Burning with fever. The air around me throbbed with the din of the helicopter's blades. The man was yelling something. I tried to focus on his mouth. It was alive, he was saying. My friend, Jonas Lear, was saying. It was alive. It was alive. It was alive. I lifted my head and looked. The room was barren, like a cell. On the wall across from me, a wide, dark window showed my reflection. I saw what I'd become. I did not rise. I launched. I rocketed across the room and hit the window with a thud. Behind the glass, the two men lurched backward. Jonas and the second one, Sykes. Their eyes were wide with fear. I pounded. I roared. I opened my jaws to display my teeth so they would know the measure of my rage. I wanted to kill them. No. Not kill. Kill is too dull a word for that which I desired. I wanted to annihilate them. I wanted to tear them limb from limb. I wanted to crack their bones and bury my face in the wet remains. I wanted to reach inside their chests and yank out their hearts and devour the bloody meat as the last stray current twitched the muscle and watch their faces as they died. They were yelling,
screaming. I was not what they'd bargained for. The glass was bowing, shuddering beneath my blows. A blast of white-hot brightness engulfed the room. I felt as if I'd been shot by 100 arrows. I stumbled backward and fell, curling to the floor. A clattering of gears above, and with a bang the bars fell, sealing me away. Tim, I'm sorry. This was never my intention. Forgive me. Perhaps he was. It made no difference. Even then, huddled in agony, I knew that their advantage was temporary. It held no weight. The walls of my prison could not help but eventually yield to my power. I was the dark flower of mankind, ordained since time's beginning to destroy a world that had no God to love it. From 1, we became 12. That, too, is a matter of record. From my blood the ancient seed was taken and passed into others. I came to know these men. At first they alarmed me. Their human lives had been very different from my own. They possessed no conscience, no pity, no philosophy. They were like brute animals, their bestial hearts full of the blackest of deeds. That such men existed I had long understood, but evil, to be truly comprehended, must be felt, experienced. One must enter into it, as into a lightless cave. One by one they came into my mind, and I into theirs. Babcock was the first. What terrible dreams he possessed, though they were in truth no worse than my own. The others followed in due course, each added to the fold. Morrison and Chavez, Baffus and Terrell, Winston and Sosa, Eccles and Lambright, Reinhardt and Martinez, vilest of all. Even Carter, whose memories of suffering blew upon the dying embers of compassion in my heart. Over time, in the company of these troubled souls, I underwent an expanding sense of mission. They were my heirs, my acolytes. Alone among them, I possessed the capacity to lead. They did not despise the world as I did. To such men the world is nothing, as everything is nothing. Their appetites knew no moderation. Unguided, they would bring down swift and total destruction upon us all. They were mine to command, but how to make them follow? What they needed was a god. 9 and 1. I commanded them in my best God voice. 9 are yours, but 1 is mine, as you are mine. Into the 10th shall be planted the seed, so that we will be many, millions fold. A reasonable person might ask, why did you do it? If I possessed the power to lead them, surely I could have put a stump to everything. The rage was part of it, yes. All that I loved had been taken from me, and that which I did not love as well, which was my human life. So too did the biological imperatives of my remanufactured self. Could you ask a hungry lion to ignore the bounty of the veldt? I do not note these things to seek the pardon of any person, because my actions are unpardonable, nor to say I'm sorry, although I am. Does that surprise you to hear? That Timothy Fanning, called Zero, is sorry? It's true. I'm sorry about everything.
I merely wish to set the stage, to place my mental contours in their proper context. What did I desire? To make the world a wasteland, to bring upon it the mirrored image of my wretched self, to punish Lear, my friend, my enemy, who believed he could save a world that was not savable, that never deserved saving in the first place. Such was my wrath in those early days. Yet I could not ignore the metaphysical aspects of my condition indefinitely. As a boy, I spoke often to the Almighty. My prayers were shallow and childish, as if I were speaking to Santa Claus. Spaghetti for dinner, a new bike at my birthday, a day of snow and no school. If, Lord, in your infinite mercy, it would not be too much trouble. How ironic. We are born faithful and afraid, when it should be the opposite. It is life that teaches us how much we stand to lose. As a grown man, I mislaid the impulse, like many people. I would not say I was a non-believer. Rather, that I gave little, if any, thought to celestial concerns. It did not seem to me that God, whoever he was, would be the sort of God to take an interest in the minutiae of human affairs, or that this fact released us from the duty to go about our lives in a spirit of decency to others. It is true that the events of my life brought me into a state of nihilistic despair, yet even in the darkest hours of my human life, the hours that to this day I dwell in, I blamed no one but myself. But as love turns to grief, and grief becomes anger, so must anger yield to thought in order to know itself. My symbolic properties were inarguable. Made by science, I was a perfect industrial product, the very embodiment of mankind's indefatigable faith in itself. Since our first furry ancestor scraped flint on stone and banished night with fire, we have climbed heavenward on a ladder made of our own arrogance. But was that all? Was I the final proof that humanity dwelled in an unwatched cosmos of no purpose? Or was I something more? Thus did I contemplate my existence. In due course, these ruminations led me to but one conclusion. I had been made for a purpose. I was not the author of destruction. I was its instrument, forged in heaven's workshop by a god of horrors. What could I do but play the part? As to my present, more human-seeming incarnation, all I can say is that Jonas was right about one thing after all, though the bastard never knew it. The events I am about to describe occurred just a few days after my emancipation, in a certain benighted prairie hamlet by the name, I was later to learn, of Sewanee, Kansas. To this day, my recollections of that early period are drowned in joy. What soaring liberty, what bountiful slaking of my appetites. The world of night seemed a glorious banquet to my senses, an infinite buffet. Yet I moved with a certain caution. No roadhouse tavern massacres, no families slaughtered whole in their beds, no fast food emporia painted red, patrons strewn willy-nilly in bloody dismemberment. These things would come eventually. But for the time being, I sought to leave a lighter footprint. Each night, as I made my way east, I dined upon only a handful,
and only in situations in which I could do so at my ease and swiftly dispose of the remains. Thus, my heart sang an aria of delight at the sight of the truck. The vehicle, a preposterously bloated and over-appointed quad-cab pickup, smokestacks, dualies, lights on the roll bar, Confederate flag decal on the bumper, was parked nose in at the lip of a flooded quarry. Its isolation was ideal, as was the distracted state of its occupants. A man and a woman in full passionate flagrante, enjoying each other as much as I was about to enjoy them. For a time, I merely watched. My gaze was not carnal. Rather, I observed with the curiosity of the scientist. Why this crummy place to do the deed? Why the awkward confines of a pickup? The man was practically crushing his beloved against the dashboard to unleash their animal splendor. Surely there were enough beds in the world to go around. They were not young. Far from it. He bald and rather portly, she scrawny and loose-skinned, the two of them a spectacle of aging flesh. What about this place had called out to them? Was it nostalgia? Had they come here when they were young? Was I witnessing a reenacted glory of youth? Then it came to me. They were merry. They just weren't married to each other. I took the woman first, astride her companion on the wide bench seat, so wildly was she pumping upon his anatomy, fists gripping the headrest, skirt bunched around her waist and underpants swinging from a bony ankle, her face angled toward the ceiling like a supplicant, that as I yanked open the door she seemed more irritated than alarmed, as if I had interrupted her in the midst of a particularly important train of thought. This, of course, did not last long, no more than a couple of seconds. It is an interesting truth that the human body, liberated from its head, is in essence a bag of blood with a built-in straw. Holding her headless torso upright, I positioned my mouth around this jetting orifice and gave it a long, muscular suck. I wasn't expecting anything much. It seemed likely that her small-town diet, rich in preservatives, would give her blood a chemical taste. But this turned out not to be the case. The woman was, in fact, delicious. Her blood was a veritable bouquet of complex flavors, like a well-aged wine. Two more robust sucks, and I cast her aside. By this time, her associate, pants puddled around his ankles, gleaming penis in rapid deflation, had gathered the wherewithal to shimmy toward the driver's side of the cab, where he was frantically attempting to isolate the truck's key from a ring of them. The ring was enormous. It was positively janitorial. Fingers trembling, he jammed one key into the slot and then another, all to no avail, muttering a chain of "Oh gods" and "Holy fucks" that were only a lightly retooled rendition of the ecstatic sounds and filthy encouragements he'd been breathing into his companion's ear mere seconds ago. The comedy was exquisite. Speaking frankly, I couldn't get enough of it. Which was my grand mistake. Had I killed him more quickly, not pausing to savor this risible display, the world we know would be a different place. As it was, my delay gave him time to locate the correct key, shove it into the ignition, turn the engine over, and reach for the gear shift before I shot into the cab, grabbed his head, tipped it to the side,
and crushed his windpipe under my jaws with a grisly crunch. So enraptured was I with the bloody feast of my hapless victim that I failed to notice what was happening, that he had put the truck in gear.
Our species' aversion to water is well known. Water is death to us. We sink like stones, our bodies lacking the buoyancy of adipose tissue. Of my plunge into the quarry I possess only a fractured recollection. The truck's slow progress to the lip of the abyss, the snatch of gravity and the inevitable plunge. Water all around me, a cocoon of cold death, engulfing my eyes and nose and lungs. From small mistakes come great catastrophes, invincible in most other aspects. I had found the quickest way to die. As the truck touched down with a soft thump upon the quarry's watery floor, I extricated myself from the cab and began to crawl along the bottom. Even in my panicked state, the irony was not lost on me. Subject Zero, World Destroyer, scuttling like a crab. My only hope was to feel my way to the edge of the pit and scale my way to freedom. Time was my enemy. I had but one bottled breath with which to save myself. A wall of rock met my desperate grasp. I began to climb. Hand over hand I made my ascent. My vision swirled with darkness. The end was closing in. How I came in due course to find myself on hands and knees, pink-fleshed, inarguably human-looking hands and knees, whilst gagging out great volumes of boggy vomitus, is a question I shall leave to the theologians. For die I surely did. The body remembers these things. Having freed myself from the quarry's waters, I had yet succumbed, and for some period of time lain as a drowned corpse upon the rocks, only to be shot back into existence. Death's doorway, it seemed, was not marked exit only, after all. The last of the quarry's waters expelled, I managed, in a state of dazed astonishment, to rise. Where was I? When was I? What was I? Such was my disorientation that it seemed that I might have dreamed it all. Then, conversely, that I was dreaming this. I held up a hand before the moon. It was, in every visible aspect, the hand of a human being. The hand of Timothy Fanning, holder of the Eloise Armstrong chair, etc. I looked down upon the rest of me. With tremulous digits I probed my face, my chest and stomach, my pale legs. Naked by moonlight, I investigated each feature of my physical person like a blind man reading Braille. I'll be goddamned, I thought. I had come to rest on a rocky shelf jutting from the quarry wall. A narrow switchback led me to the top, where I emerged into an area of rusted machinery half buried by weeds. The hour was unknown to me. Save for the moon, no lights burned anywhere. The landscape was one of such uninhabited desolation, the world might have ended already. The quarry's waters would conceal my second victim, but there was the woman to consider. The last thing I wanted was a police manhunt to complicate matters. I circled the quarry to the parking area. The sight of her aroused no remorse, just the sort of perfunctory, quickly dispatched pity one might feel reading a newspaper account of some distant catastrophe over one's second slice of morning toast. Two distant splashes, body, head, and into the watery deep she went.
none of which did anything to solve the problem of being a naked, full-grown man at large in an unknown countryside. I needed clothes, shelter, a story. Also, a certain mental agitation, like an inaudible siren in my brain, told me that should daybreak find me in the open, nothing happy would ensue. The main highway was too risky. I headed for the woods, hoping that I might eventually come to some lesser-traveled thoroughfare. At length I emerged into a landscape of freshly planted fields bisected by a dirt road. In the distance, I saw a light and headed toward it. A small, rather dilapidated one-story house of nondescript design, little more than a box in which to store a human life. The light I'd seen was a lamp in one of the two front windows. There was no car in the driveway, suggesting that the house was unoccupied, the light left burning in anticipation of its owner's return. The door obediently opened onto a living room of particle board furniture, country-themed bric-a-brac, and a television the size of a jumbotron. A quick survey of the interior, four rooms and a kitchen, confirmed my impression that no one was home. My inspection further revealed that the occupant was a woman, had attended nursing school at Wichita State, was in her late 40s, possessed a soft, moon-like face and gray hair she didn't do much with, wore a size 20, was frequently photographed in a state of rosy-cheeked inebriation in ethnic-themed restaurants, wearing a plastic lei, flirting shamelessly with the mariachis, holding up a flaming fondue spike, and that she lived alone. From her wardrobe I selected the most neutral things I could find, a pair of sweatpants, voluminous on my mid-sized masculine frame, a hooded sweatshirt, likewise huge, and a pair of flip-flops, and entered the bathroom. The sight that greeted me in the mirror was not wholly unexpected. By this time it had become apparent to me that the physical act of drowning had not wholly restored me to my human state, but wrought upon my person something more like costumery. The virus remained. My death had merely excited it into some new interaction with its host. Many attributes had been preserved. Vision, hearing, smell, all had retained their supercharged acuteness. Though I had yet to put them to a proper test, my limbs, indeed my entire physical carriage, bones to blood, hummed with bestial strength. Yet these things hardly prepared me for what I saw. My complexion was unnaturally pale, almost cadaverous. My hair, which had miraculously grown back, triangulated at my forehead to a comically perfect widow's peak. My eyes possessed the alien rosiness of an albino's. But the final detail was the one that stopped me flat. At first I thought it was a joke. Behind the corners of my upper lip, amidst otherwise ordinary dentition, two white points dripped like icicles. Or, more precisely, fangs. Dracula. Nosferatu. Vampire. I can barely utter the names without a roll of the eyes. Yet here I was, Jonas Lear's fantasy incarnate, a legend come to life. The crunch of tires on gravel aroused me. As I emerged from the lavatory, a pair of headlights raked the room. I ducked behind a coat tree just in time for the door to fling open with a gust of spring air. The woman, whose name was Janet Duff, I'd gotten this from the framed diploma hung above the bill-cluttered desk in her bedroom, lumbered inside, wearing the flowered smock, white polyester trousers, and sensible shoes of a nurse coming off the late night shift. Without missing a beat, she deposited her ring of keys on the table by the door, kicked off her shoes, flung her overstuffed purse onto a chair, and made her way back to the kitchen, from when